PRI's Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC New York and Public Radio International and is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Tall dry cappuccino at the bar?
Thank you.
So I'm sitting in a Starbucks sipping my usual triple grande latte, thinking about how weird it is that it's named after the first mate in Melville's Moby Dick. Starbucks, I mean, not the grande latte. And then I think, what an enduring brand. Here I am, 150 years after it was written, still thinking of Herman Melville's big, rolling, difficult novel.
You're to look for the white whale.
Come on, men!
And I start remembering scenes from when I first read Moby Dick 30 years ago. The harpoon chase at night.
Thirsty blows!
The sailor who falls into a dead whale's head at sea. Plummeting toward the bottom until at the last second, Queequeg, the tattooed South Sea Islander, dives in to haul his fellow crewman out. I remember Captain Ahab swearing vengeance at God and Moby Dick with St. Elmo's fire flickering white flames on the yardarms of his ship, the Pequod.
It lights our way to the white whale!
And I remember all those digressive chapters that really had nothing to do with the plot at all.
Regarding the sperm whale's head as a solid oblong, you may, on an inclined plane, sideways...
The ones that filled about half the book, where Melville meditates at length on the shape of a whale's forehead and on the whiteness of the whale.
Its broad forward end forming the expanded vertical apparent forehead of the whale.
So what makes a philosophical, comic, tragic adventure tale still matter so much after 150 years? I decided to find out. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, we're going on a chase after Moby Dick through movies, music, paintings, and books in which he's left his traces ever since Herman Melville released him in 1851.
It is the strangest book I've ever read. It's so weird.
We'll hear from some of the most creative and interesting people in America who have been inspired by this American icon, like performance artist Laurie Anderson.
I fell in love with it.
The artist Frank Stella thought he'd make a few pieces about Moby Dick, but then spent more than 10 years obsessed with the book.
It took a kind of energy out of me, and it was against everything that I'd ever thought about what painting should be.
And Tony Kushner, who was an impressionable young playwright who hadn't yet written Angels in America when he read Moby Dick.
Of any work of literature, it had the single greatest impact on my writing.
This is Studio 360, the Moby Dick edition. Moby Dick begins with one of the most famous first lines in literature.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can.
That's the actor Edward Herman, who is our reader for Moby Dick today. Ishmael seizes the stage with his first three words and then seduces us with what follows. But Laurie Anderson says the opening sentence is one of the most deceptive in the book.
Call me Ishmael, you're going, well, that only works for about three pages, and then he starts talking about other stuff. So this guy, Ishmael, is deciding to ship out, and he's telling you why in the first few pages of the book. You know, I could go as an officer if I wanted to. I could go as a harpooner. Or, you know, I could go as a cook. But And, you know, there's nothing like a really good broiled chicken. And, you know, the Egyptians loved broiled chicken, too, as you could tell from the mummies of roasted river horse and ibis that you find in their giant bakehouses, the pyramids. And you're going, wait, what kind of book is this? And he is the master of the jump cut, you know, which I just love. And the cool thing about this book is, you know, it's tiny little chapters, he's interested in so many different things, polar bears and, you know, theories about the beginnings of the world and, you know, how deep is the ocean kind of thing. And you just drift around in this book and you can read it in little chunks because there is no plot. I mean, you know the plot, the ship's going to go down, that's it.
How to find you, maybe by your singing. We trail notes in the water. One white whale in all these oceans. One white whale.
Laurie Anderson was so taken with Moby Dick that she spent the 1990s writing an opera she called Songs and Stories from Moby Dick. We'll hear more from it later in the show. Juilliard is a college for actors, musicians, and dancers in New York City. The writer Stanley Crouch teaches a seminar there on jazz in American culture. And in that course, he includes a section on Moby Dick. Even though the novel was written more than half a century before jazz was born, one night before Professor Crouch arrived for a 7:30 class, his students had a chance to vent their feelings about the book.
I have a 60-page thesis due in less than 2 weeks, and there's no way I'm reading Moby Dick in 2 weeks. So
it's basically like about nothing.
What is the book? At that point, Stanley Crouch gave the students the hairy eyeball and walked up to a corner of the room, opened up the wall cabinet to get to the stereo, and pressed play.
Now, the reason I wanted to play you that was because it seems to me that in this piece of James P. Johnson's, who's often considered the father of stride piano, is that it has to me that same kind of a feeling that we get in Moby Dick, which is that you have these motifs, but they keep changing form. Moby Dick is largely an improvisation in which you observe Herman Melville following his ear through the book. That is, that Moby Dick is probably about as close to a spontaneously written book as you're going to encounter. He gets to the end of a chapter and says, okay, what now? I say, oh, okay, I'll try that. And then he goes with it. It's like the thing that's so amazing about it is that form-wise, the book is an extraordinary exhibition of absolute fearlessness. Now, his objective is to break down the single perspective. I mean, a chapter can start off in the first person, and it's I, Ishmael, am telling you X, Y, and Z. Then it can suddenly switch to a dramatic form that is in the style of a theater piece. And characters leave and come in on the basis of stage instructions that are written in parentheses. And to this day, that's still very unusual. In 1850, it was actually revolutionary. Long though it may be, nothing is in there purely to be there. I mean, it's all connected, and it all takes you into territories about American life and about just the nature of life itself.
All men live enveloped in whale lines. All are born with halters round their necks. But it is only when caught in the swift, sudden turn of death that mortals realize the silent, subtle, ever-present perils of life. And if you be a philosopher, though seated in the whaleboat, you would not at heart feel one whit more of terror than though seated before your evening fire with a poker and not a harpoon by your side.
And the other thing, why are the whales slaughtered in the first place? For what?
For oil.
For oil for what?
Use it for, to burn, to fuel light.
There. That'll do. So these lamps that lit these people's homes, that made it possible for them to see after sundown, were fueled by this whale oil. So then again, we have another one of those Melvillian ironies, which is that slaughter leads to light. The slaughter leads to light. Now, are there any questions?
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, where today we're chasing Moby Dick, that great American icon. Now, I know that unlike Professor Crouch's students, you know the book perfectly. Okay, maybe you've forgotten just a little of what happens. Or maybe, like some of those students, you've never even read it? Well, to get us all up to speed on what happens in Moby Dick, we asked playwright David Ives to reduce its mammoth bulk to handy short attention span size. We proudly present the world premiere of Moby Dude, starring Mark Price as a contemporary young reader surfing through what is arguably the greatest American novel in 2 minutes flat.
Call me Ishmael, dude. Yes, Miss Podgorski, I did read Moby Dick over the summer like I was supposed to. It was bodacious. Actually, you know, it's Moby hyphen Dick. Title's got a little hyphen before the dick. What is the meaning of this dash before the dick? Whoa! Another mystery in this awesome American masterpiece. A peerless allegorical saga of mortal courage, metaphysical ambiguity, and maniacal obsession. What, Miss Podgorski? You don't believe I really read Herman Melville's Moby Dick or the Whale? 562 pages, 14 ounces, published 1851, totally tanked its first weekend, re-released in the 1920s as one of the world's gnarliest works of art? You think I copped all this, like, off the back of the tome or by watching that crappy 1956 film starring Gregory Peck? Miss P., you've been on my tail since middle school. Do I get all testy? Do I say what is the plot in under 2 minutes besides a whale and a hyphen? Moby Dick, in 2 minutes, huh? Okay, cool. Let's rip. Fade in. Boonies of Massachusetts, 18-something. Young dude, possibly named Ishmael, like the Bible, meets cute with, ta-da, Queequeg. South Sea cannibal with a heart of gold.
Aww.
Maybe they're gay. Or maybe they represent some East-West pagan-Christian duality action. Anyway, two newfound bros go to mass and hear a sermon about Jonah, biblical tie-in, then ship out on Christmas Day, could be symbolical, aboard the USS Pequod with its mysterious wacko Captain Ahab. Who, backstory, is Goofyfoot, because the equally mysterious mongoozeloid white whale Moby, like the singer, Dick, bit his leg off. Freudian castration action. I mean, he's big, he's got sperm, and his last name is Dick, right? Moby is also a metaphor for God, nature, truth, obsessical love, the world, the past, and white people. Check out Pip, the Negro cabin boy, who by a fluke goes wacko too. Ahab says,
"Bring me the head of the great white whale, and you win this prize."
Crew is stoked, but not first mate like the coffee Starbuck. Ahab wants the big one, Starbuck wants the whale juice. Idealism versus capitalism.
Ooh.
Radical! Queequeg tells the carpenter to build him a coffin shaped like a canoe. Foreshadowing. Then, lots of chapters everybody skips about the Scientology of whales. Cut to page 523, the Pacific Ocean. Surf's up! Ahab sucks a dick. He's totally amped. The boards hit the waves. The crew snakes a dick for 3 whole days. Bottom of the third, Ahab is 10 toes on the nose. He's aggro. Moby goes aerial. Ahab's in the zone. He fires his choicest harpoon. The rope does a 360 round his neck. Ahab crushes out. Moby totals the Pequod. Everybody eats it except our faithful narrator Ishmael, who boogies to safety on Queequeg's coffin.
"And I only am escaped alone to tell thee."
Roll final credits. The end. So, what do you say, Miss Podgorski? You want to, like, hang and catch a cup of Starbucks sometime? Tubular!
Mark Price in Moby Dude, which the playwright David Ives very kindly created just for this show. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm sitting here now with Elizabeth Schultz, who is a deeply educated Melville scholar.
And that's a fabulous three-minute summary. He really catches just about all of the points.
He does indeed. And also with, obviously, a sense of humor, but a fairly deep reading of the book as well.
Absolutely. And let me tell you that many of the opening passages are hysterically funny. So it's humor is altogether appropriate.
Well, you know, that's funny. A thing people don't know about Melville is that he was, at the time, well known as a humor writer.
Yeah, he was. And he knew every brand of humor that was going. I mean, he was ironical. He was satirical. He was just loaded down with puns. He could do all the voices, just like the reader of the play did.
Let's hope that Melville would appreciate this bit of homage.
Oh, I think he would.
You taught English and art history at the University of Kansas to those sorts of tubular guys and girls for many years. How do you find they react to this novel?
I would say that Moby Dick elicits a fabulously wide, diverse, unpredictable range of responses. There are those who find that the novel is dumbing and numbing, and there are those who don't hesitate to compare Moby Dick to the Bible. It's the book that they have close by to open at any moment in any place, and that it continues to inspire their lives.
When white in all these oceans, one white whale.
Like Hamlet, it's one of the few works of art that is truly inexhaustible. Everything that's conceivable exists in one form or another, and it's so full of incredible delight.
The playwright Tony Kushner was a graduate student when he fell in love with Moby Dick, and he says the novel is the greatest single influence on his own writing.
I found it set a kind of voice free in me. I felt completely overwhelmed by the excessiveness of it and these sentences that go on and on and on and on and on forever. And really within each sentence, I mean, let alone each chapter or each book, but each sentence risks collapse by extending itself longer than it can possibly go. And I became interested as a playwright in sort of reading these passages out loud and beginning to think about dramatic language that did that.
How wonderful is it then, except after explanation, that this great monster, to whom corporeal warmth is as indispensable as it is to man. How wonderful that he should be found at home, immersed to his lips for life in those Arctic waters, where when seamen fall overboard, they are sometimes found months afterwards perpendicularly frozen into the hearts of fields of ice, as a fly is found glued in amber. But more surprising is it to know, as has been proved by experiment, that the blood of a polar whale is warmer than that of a Borneo negro in summer. It does seem to me that herein we see the rare virtue of a strong individual vitality, and the rare virtue of thick walls, and the rare virtue of interior spaciousness. O man, admire and model thyself after the whale. Do thou too remain warm among ice. Do thou too live in this world without being of it. Be cool at the equator. Keep thy blood fluid at the pole. Like the great dome of St. Peter's and like the great whale, retain, O man, in all seasons, a temperature of thine own.
I love that it shatters the form of the novel. It seems to offer a license for complete indulgence, but now that I've read a lot of Melville, I know it's something that he repeats over and over again, that it's better to make a terrible mistake, it's better to make an utter fool of yourself and to risk catastrophe than to be safe as an artist.
The playwright Tony Kushner. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. In a few minutes, we'll hear from more artists who have been inspired by Moby Dick. Meanwhile, here's a question to ponder. When you think of a Captain Ahab type, a single-minded leader chasing around the world for a great monster he despises, who comes to mind?
It's been seen as the story of a fascist, the story of a totalitarian communist, and most recently, the story of a terrorist.
Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting In the Heart of the Moon, an instrumental duet album by Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré and Toumani Diabaté on African harp, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Today, we're tracking the great white whale, Moby Dick. This 150-year-old book is still relevant today. Moby Dick lies in the depths of the American subconscious almost all the time, including in politics. In the dark fall of 2001, images from Moby Dick surfaced in the press as a strange literary footnote to the most shocking event of the last half century. Trey Kay tells the story.
5 days after the September 11th attacks, the political commentator Edward Said published an essay in the London Observer. In the essay, he alluded to President George W. Bush as Captain Ahab and Osama bin Laden as the White Whale. After that, a flood of articles, editorials, and internet chatter picked up on the Moby Dick analogy, except the characters kept shifting.
Ahab as George Bush pursuing Osama bin Laden, Ahab as Osama bin Laden pursuing the West, and Ahab as Osama bin Laden pursuing the symbol, not of the whale, but of the World Trade Center towers.
That's Sam Otter, professor of English literature from the University of California at Berkeley. He says the analogies have one theme in common.
That is the model of Ahab's pursuit of Moby Dick, of Ahab taking Moby Dick to represent all that most maddens and torments, the object that if he fixed, if he caught, would solve his problems.
Drawing political analogies to Moby Dick isn't anything new. It's been going on since the book was published in 1851. Columbia University English professor Andrew Del Banco says that Moby Dick analogies might have foreshadowed the American Civil War.
Some have seen in it the mania for hunting down the power of the Federal Union on the part of someone who reminds them very much of John C. Calhoun, the spokesman for the secessionist South. It's been seen as quite the opposite, that is, as an allegory of the North obsessed with hunting down the secessionist South. It's been seen as the allegory of a business culture that will stop at nothing in terms of exploiting the natural world for its own purposes and for the benefit of human consumption. It's been seen as the story of a fascist, the story of a totalitarian communist, and most recently, the story of a terrorist who will stop at nothing in order to gain his objectives, and indeed as the story of a nation that will stop at nothing that gets in the way of hunting down that terrorist.
It's Captain Ahab who attracts most of the political attention, but not just because of his monomania. It's also the way that he lures followers to his obsessive path by the power of his stirring speeches.
Ahab is a great orator, and the greatness of his oratory is that he's able to communicate to his men the ultimate importance to him of coming face to face with this force in the universe for which he blames his suffering. And he's able to make them feel that if they can join him in this quest, they will be able to reach some kind of understanding or some kind of sense of satisfaction about their own mortality and their own suffering in the world. He makes evil, as Melville puts it, practically assailable.
All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed. There, some unknown but still unreasoning thing puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike through the mask, how can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me, he heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. And be the white whale agent or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. For could the sun do that, then could I do the other. Since there is ever a sort of fair play here in jealousy presiding over all creations. But not my master man is even that fair play. Who's over me? Truth has no confines.
Del Banco says that in order to teach his students about the power that Ahab had over his men, he references the most dangerous leaders of history. Before he had the example of Osama bin Laden, he would point further back to Hitler.
If you look back into the 20th century, you see that the greatest disaster of the 20th century, the conflagration that consumed Europe in the 30s and 40s, was provoked by a great orator who gave his people the opportunity to make evil practically assailable, namely by identifying it with the Jews.
Of course, Melville wasn't riding with Hitler in mind. Some think he modeled Ahab after Napoleon. But he may have also been thinking about American politics.
I think there are many features of Moby Dick that make it relevant for political analogies. Probably the foremost is that it's an intricate, rich work of art, which, like other rich works of art, has wide resonance, tends to speak from the past to the present.
Sam Otter says that's why everyone from the noble savage Queequeg to Starbuck, the principled but weak first mate, has been invoked in politics. But whenever we look for meaning in this classic tale, according to Andrew Del Banco, we're like the 30 sailors aboard the Pequod.
There's a great chapter, more or less, at the center of the book called The Doubloon, which describes how Captain Ahab nails a shiny Ecuadorian gold coin to the mast and offers it as a reward for the first man to spy the white whale. And one by one, the officers of the Pequod step before this doubloon and stare into it, and what they see in it, of course, is a reflection of themselves.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kaye.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, where we're chasing the white whale today, along with Ishmael and Queequeg and Starbuck and Captain Ahab.
We see him only in parts, a flash of a tail, his beating heart, he's in pieces and parts.
The composer and performer Laurie Anderson was inspired by the novel to write a strange, cool, modern opera. Her songs and stories for Moby Dick premiered in 1999, and here's a taste of it.
And I'm thinking about two well-known epic American stories that are about work and control. And they're both stories about teams of people working in ships. And the stories are Star Trek and Moby Dick, and their ships, the Enterprise and the Pequod. And these stories are separated by almost 150 years. And although they have a lot in common, very long voyage, powerful captain, dangerous encounters and wild adventures, they couldn't be more different. In the Star Trek series, the ship is pretty high-tech, and the immaculate workers are endlessly typing commands into their computers and talking into their headsets, presumably affecting the course of the ship somehow. But the person who's really in charge is up on the bridge. And the plot of each episode is the same. Everybody's working away, and suddenly, for some reason or other, the ship goes out of control, and the captain starts yelling from the bridge. I've lost control. I've lost control of the ship. Now, losing control is the worst thing that could happen. And the whole plot of the story is how the captain regains control of the ship. And it's no coincidence that the whole drama happens in the control room. Now, in Moby Dick, the ship is also pretty high-tech. It's a kind of floating factory, at least by 19th century standards it is. And there's the hard-working crew and the captain. Except in this ship, the captain is completely crazy. But what finally happens in Moby Dick is pretty horrendous. The captain goes more or less insane. The ship is snapped in half. The crew drowns. And the captain is dragged to the bottom of the ocean by the whale he's been fanatically hunting. The end. And there aren't even any little epigrams. Like in King Lear, when at the end the king learns that he can love some people just a little bit. In Moby Dick, it all just ends. And it's such an incredibly dark story. I mean, you can't imagine telling a story like that now. For example, the Enterprise explodes in a huge accident, and all the debris from the wreck gets sucked into a black hole. And in the last shot, there's a single spaceman turning around, swinging around and around, alone in space. Call me Ishmael. The end. Now, this would never happen, even if it was the very last episode, and the series was slated to go permanently off the air. But what I'm trying to say is that here we are in the late 20th century, and we're designing our own personal control rooms. And the stories we tell ourselves are about how to get more and more perfect. More. In control.
We've been listening to Laurie Anderson from her project Songs and Stories from Moby Dick. And in fact, Melville's Moby Dick does appear in a number of Star Trek movies. In First Contact, the Borg, the enemy cyborg race, have hurt the Starship Enterprise's Captain Picard. And Picard might now risk the welfare of his whole crew to get back at the Borg. But a woman from Earth's past confronts him.
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt your little quest. Captain Ahab has to go hunt his whale.
What?
You do have books in the 24th century.
This is not about revenge.
Liar!
This is about saving the future of humanity!
Jean-Luc, blow up the damn ship!
No!
Captain Picard smashes all the model ships around it.
See you around, Ahab.
And he piled on the whale's white hump the sum of all the rage and hate felt by his whole race. If his chest had been a cannon, he would have shot his heart upon it.
What?
Moby Dick?
Actually, I never read it.
Back in the day, the band Led Zeppelin also riffed on the Great White Whale in this song called Moby Dick. But painters, when they try to depict the white whale, are really defying Melville's own words.
Any way you may look at it, you must needs conclude that the great Leviathan is that one creature in the world which must remain unpainted to the last. True, one portrait may hit the mark much nearer than another, but none can hit it with any very considerable degree of exactness. So there is no earthly way of finding out precisely what the whale really looks like.
The great illustrator Rockwell Kent tried it anyway in the Depression era of 1930 with his melancholy black-and-white line engravings of toothy whales and Nantucket swabbies and a terrifying Captain Ahab. If you prefer your art more abstract and ambitious, there's also something for you. The sculptor and painter Frank Stella has been a star since the 1960s, first for his black paintings and then his geometric abstractions with bright colors. Then he visited Rome and saw Caravaggio's, pictures of saints and martyrs and their sacrifices and ecstasies. And he came to feel in the 1980s that modern abstract artists, like himself, needed to try to match the power of the great narrative paintings of the old masters. Frank Stella was looking for a story. And he found it by accident, spending some time with his kids.
When I was in my, second marriage, I had two boys. And, we spent a lot of time, for one reason or another, going to the aquarium in Brooklyn. And in order to get in, you have to go walk by those beluga whales in the tank. And they started to prey on my mind. And then I thought I might really just use the titles from Moby Dick. I was discussing it with my son, Michael, and I said, well, I like Moby Dick, and it's kind of interesting, and I'm working on these pieces, but, I can't come up with 135 images. And my son Michael said, you just have to do a few. And then I got so mad at him for saying, you don't really have to do them all. You just do whatever. That then I said, I'm going to do them all.
Obsession, anyone? For the next 12 years, from 1985 to 1997, Frank Stella produced 266 Moby Dick artworks. When he started the series, he was basically a painter and printmaker, but the Moby Dick works grew into huge painted and unpainted metal reliefs and sculptures and collages and prints and a block-long mural and a model for a building that is yet to be built.
I was taken with the book as a whole. I'm not trying to illustrate it or copy it or anything. I'm trying to create an action at the level that the action takes place in the book.
His Moby Dick sculptures are installed all over the world now, but one of them is still mounted on the wall of his studio in Lower Manhattan. It's just over 8 feet tall and nearly that wide. Like a lot of his work, it blurs the boundaries between painting and sculpture. A tall, ridged chunk of metal draws the eye, and the waves in the metal are highlighted by stripes of fluorescent pink and orange and magenta. And overlaying all of that in the center is a separate, sharp, right-angled piece.
It's called the quadrant. quadrant's an instrument that you use to locate yourself in space or on the sea or whatever. And that was in response to the sun on the Sea of Japan, which was the unblinking sun and the brightness of it. So the thing that's in the background is the wave or the whale and everything. This is about, you know, what's out there and what's the and what how beautiful it is on the sea and everything, and the vividness of the experience.
Now, in that Japanese sea, the days in summer are as freshets of effulgences. That unblinking, vivid Japanese sun seems the blazing focus of the glassy ocean's immeasurable burning glass. The sky looks lacquered. Clouds there are none. The horizon floats. And this nakedness of unrelieved radiance is as the insufferable splendors of God's throne. Well that Ahab's quadrant was furnished with colored glasses through which to take sight of that solar fire.
Mainly it's about the momentum, which is, I suppose, something like the voyage. You know, I mean, you know, Ahab was going to go around and get going. He's going to make the trip one way or the other.
And did you feel at the end that, unlike Ahab, you had succeeded at doing what you intended?
I succeeded about as much as Ahab did. I destroyed myself.
But so when you jokingly say destroyed me, how is that true, if that's half true?
Well, I think that it took a kind of energy out of me, and it was against everything that I'd ever thought about what painting should be, and I proved to myself it could be another way. The movement and the wave shape, the curve is just different. Although most of the things have a kind of rigid structure, I mean a pretty rigid personality, they still manage to move and loosen up a little bit. Now, I never know if this change of pace is a lack of progression or whether it's really a progression from what I should have been doing. So I don't know if I'm doing the right thing or not.
As you look back on it as a finished series, do you gainsay yourself, second-guess yourself, anything you did?
Mainly just, you know, I still feel bad a little bit about, you know, trading on Melville. I didn't mean to do that, but the titles are, they're such good titles, if nothing else. I mean, I don't know. That the group as a whole, that's it. I think it stands on its own. Actually, I feel fairly free from it. And I don't think I did or could do anything that, I don't know, that intense again.
I urge you to find one of Stella's Moby Dick works in a museum or installed in an office building somewhere and experience the complicated power in person. But in the meantime, if you'd like to see some images, you can visit our website, studio360.org. As we were leaving Frank Stella's studio in Lower Manhattan, out on the street on 4th Avenue, I realized we were just a 2-minute walk around the corner from where Herman Melville lived when he started dreaming up Moby Dick.
He rises! I spit my last breath at thee!
In a minute, the great fantasy and science fiction master Ray Bradbury will tell us how he channeled Herman Melville to adapt his huge novel for the screen.
So for one day, I was Herman Melville. It was in my bloodstream and it came out my fingertips.
Please stay with us in Studio 360 from Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting In the Heart of the Moon, an instrumental duet album by Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré and Toumani Diabaté on African harp, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
You're listening to Studio 360 on the hunt for the great white whale. I'm Kurt Anderson. Now, imagine trying to adapt Moby Dick for the movies. Just turning its adventure story into a decent screenplay would be hard enough, let alone all the philosophical asides and social commentary and digressions on the zoology of whales. But in the early 1950s, Ray Bradbury, who at the time was a young writer, not yet the world-famous master of fantasy and science fiction, was asked to adapt Moby Dick for the movies.
This is what you've shipped for, man. To chase that white whale on both sides of land and over all sides of earth till he spouts black blood and rolls dead out. What say you?
I called Ray Bradbury at his home in Los Angeles, and I asked him what he thought of Moby Dick before the director, John Huston, got in touch with him.
When he said, will you come and write the screenplay for Moby Dick, I said, hell, I've never read the damn thing. He said, I tell you what, kid, you go home tonight and read as much as you can and come back tomorrow and tell me if you'll help me kill the white whale. So I went home that night and I said to my wife, pray for me. She said, why? I said, because I've got to read a book tonight and do a book report tomorrow. So I could only read about 150 pages, but then I scanned through the rest and I saw that the metaphors enticed me, that I was a metaphorician myself and didn't know it.
So you were obviously out to sort of capture the nuance and the metaphor that Melville was trying for in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, what you try to do when you adapt anything is get it into your bloodstream, get it into your subconscious. You can't intellectualize about it. That won't work. But if you read a book 80 or 90 times, which I did, and some sections 120 times, and you put that all into your bloodstream, and then you ignore it and let it come to the surface emotionally, passionately, so you become the chaser and the chased.
Oh, did you see him, man? Did you see his hump like a great snow hill? Did you see the way he slides along? Oh, there's majesty for you. Don't look. I'll look for you.
You have to be as impassioned writing the screenplay as Ahab was chasing the whale.
Well, and you've written about that, I guess jokingly, but not, but also seriously, that this screenplay, trying to crack the code of this screenplay of Moby Dick, was effectively your own white whale.
Oh, in many ways, yes, of course. And finally, after 8 months of reading and rereading, I looked in the mirror and I cried. I pointed at myself and I said, I am Herman Melville. And I rushed to the typewriter, and for 8 hours, I typed passionately and wildly and hotly. And at the end of 8 hours, I had 35 pages of the ending of the screenplay. And I ran across London and I threw the screenplay pages in John Huston's lap. He read the 35 pages. He says, my God, you've done it. Let's start the cameras. He said, what happened? I said, behold, Herman Melville stands before you. And I said, but look quickly, because he'll be gone in 5 minutes. So for one day, I was Herman Melville. It was in my bloodstream, and it came out my fingertips.
That's how it happens in the movies. I didn't know it happened in real life ever that way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, it's the only way.
What was the hardest thing for you to capture from the novel that you wanted to have in the film?
Just putting all the metaphors together so they encircled each other, so they interlocked with each other and connected. The first thing I did when I got to Paris and I had my first meeting with John Huston, and we were walking along the Champs-Élysées, and I turned to him and I said, Mr. Huston, can we do one thing before I start work on the screenplay? He said, what? I said, at the end of the book, it's Fedallah who's pulled overboard by Moby Dick. Well, come on. It should be Ahab. So when you see the screenplay, that's my addition. That's not Melville. I eliminated Fedallah and allowed Moby Dick to come in direct contact with Ahab.
He rises! I spit my last breath at thee! Thou damned whale!
It's Ahab who's pulled overboard, bound to the side of the whale by hempen ropes, and he's dead. He goes down into the water and up, and when he comes up, the roll of the tides causing the whale to turn from side to side makes Ahab's dead arm gesture, so it looks like he's beckoning the men on to follow.
You see?
And the men see that
Ahab beckons. He's dead, but he beckons.
And pursue the white whale to their doom.
And after him! After him!
Well, that's not in the book, but I put it in the screenplay. I'm very proud of that. I'd like to think that Melville, if he saw the film, would approve of Ahab being on the side of the whale and gesturing to the men.
Ray Bradbury, thank you so much for joining me in Studio 360 today to talk about Moby Dick.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye now.
We're going to end today's exploration with Elizabeth Schultz, who we talked to at the beginning of the program. She's devoted a long career to introducing new generations to the book at the University of Kansas. Beth Schultz is absolutely passionate about Moby Dick. She even admits to being obsessed with it. I asked her to tell me her favorite scene in the book.
Ah, Kurt. How many there are. Well, depending on the day, depending on the weather, I can think of a passage that would be right. But yes, there are a good number of passages.
Tell me one, given today's weather.
Well, let me refer to a passage in the Grand Armada chapter. This is a chapter in which the Pequod enters into a part of the world, a part of the ocean, where there are circles upon circles of whales. And it is at this moment when we see the whaling endeavor at its most horrific, at its greediest, at its most exploitive, because the whaleboats go out one after another, and they shoot countless harpoons into the bodies of whales. It is a terrible, bloody scene.
In about 3 minutes' time, Queequeg's harpoon was flung. The stricken fish darted blinding spray in our faces, and then running away with us like light, steered straight for the heart of the herd. Though such a movement on the part of the whales struck under such circumstances is in no wise unprecedented, and indeed is almost always more or less anticipated, yet does it present one of the more perilous vicissitudes of the fishery. For as the swift monster drags you deeper and deeper into the frantic shoal, you bid adieu to circumspect life and only exist in a delirious throb.
And it is in the midst of this mayhem, this bloody operation, that they enter into a circle of whales. They go through what is called a living wall. That's Melville's phrase, a living wall of whales. And in the middle of this pod, they look down into the water is very clear. And there they see whales making love. They see mother whales with their babes. They see a whale, a baby whale that has just been born and is still in the shape of a turned fetal shape as if it has just come from its mother's womb.
But far beneath this wondrous world upon the surface, another and still stranger world met our eyes as we gazed over the side. For suspended in those watery vaults floated the forms of the nursing mothers of the whales, and those that by their enormous girth seemed shortly to become mothers. The lake, as I have hinted, was to a considerable depth exceedingly transparent. And as human infants, while suckling, will calmly and fixedly gaze away from the breast, as if leading two different lives at the time, and while yet drawing mortal nourishment, be still spiritually feasting upon some unearthly reminiscence, even so did the young of these whales seem looking up towards us, but not at us, as if we were but a bit of gulf weed in their newborn sight.
It is a moment when Ishmael believes that it is possible to recognize the chaos and the cruelty of the world on the one hand, and yet still believe in domesticity, in a mysterious and wondrous and incomprehensible continuity to life itself.
And thus, though surrounded by circle upon circle of consternations and affrights, did these inscrutable creatures at the center freely and fearlessly indulge in all peaceful concernments, yea, serenely reveled in dalliance and delight. But even so, amid the tornadoed Atlantic of my being, do I myself still forever centrally disport in mute calm, and while ponderous planets of unwaning woe revolve round me, deep down and deep inland, there I still bathe me in eternal mildness of joy.
The adventure, the mystery, the terror, the philosophy, the ugliness, and all that beauty. All of this is what's made Moby Dick singular and made it last. But don't take my word for it. Go read the book. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and I thank you for coming along on this journey. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Peter Clowney,
Jonathan Mitchell,
Edward Lipson,
Derek John,
Adam Allington,
Eric Malinsky,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Amol Mathre,
Katie Gradowski,
Chris Roos.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. Thanks to Edward Herman for being our narrator in this special edition of Studio 360's American Icons project about Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Thanks also to Nick Harcourt and KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic for the recording of Laurie Anderson. And special thanks to Mary Beth Kirchner, Barbara Taylor, Sarah Lilly, Andrew Dobanko, Tom Lewis, Elizabeth Schultz, and Calvin Skaggs.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Great Ideas Brought to Life.
PRI, Public Radio International.